KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 9:04.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical for the next 5 months. I'm filling in for him until October. Thousands of people rallied yesterday under beautiful blue skies and sunshine. Participants in the annual May Day gatherings advocated for immigration reform and fair working conditions, among other causes. And for most of yesterday, those demonstrations were peaceful. But you've probably heard by now, around 8 last evening, the mood changed. A rally in March that started around 6 o'clock on Capitol Hill in Seattle turned into a confrontation in downtown Seattle. And that confrontation was broadcast live by local television stations. Seattle Police Department Incident Commander Chris Fowler told reporters last night that once a group of marchers started to break windows and throw rocks and bottles, the police moved in to make arrests and things got even rowdier. Seattle Times reported this morning the police took 17 people into custody last night. Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, speaking late yesterday evening, said, "We're a bigger and better city than this. I look at what happened and I'm disappointed that this is the picture the world sees of us." KUOW's Liz Jones was out on Capitol Hill this morning, and she has this portrait of the aftermath.
This morning, things are all cleaned up pretty much. The streets are clean. Crews were out last night making sure everything was clean, all the glass is off the streets. There are two businesses here that sustained some damage. Bill's off Broadway on Pine Street, and also the Walgreens at Pine and Broadway have boarded up windows where protesters smashed in windows there. Also reports last night of some car windows being smashed. And another business a few blocks from here, Sun Liquors, that also apparently had a window smashed. I haven't seen that one yet, though. Talked to a few people out on the streets this morning. It's kind of, you know, business as usual. A lot of people jogging, going to work, going to school. One student here at Seattle Central walking by said he was really disappointed to see the protest turn violent last night. He didn't see any reason for the violence. He didn't see any reason for the protest. And he said he supports protests in general, but not when there's no reason to it. Also spoke to the business owner across the street from Bill's on Broadway, who was sad to see her neighbor's business vandalized like that, and said as a small business owner, it would be hard for her to sustain that kind of loss for her own business, that money coming out of her own pocket.
That's KUOW's Liz Jones on Seattle's Capitol Hill this morning. We're going to be following the aftermath of yesterday's protests throughout the day on weekday and on KUOW. President Obama held a news conference early this week, and among the subjects he addressed was the ongoing war in Syria and when and how the U.S. might increase its involvement, both financially and militarily. Obama told reporters, while there is evidence that chemical weapons have been used in Syria, the U.S. has no direct proof of when, where, or how those weapons were deployed. The president said the U.S. will not step up its military involvement on the side of Syrian rebels at this point, despite calls from other politicians to do so. In the 2 years since the Syrian conflict started, tens of thousands of people have lost their lives. Millions of people have been displaced, both inside and outside the country. The Christian Science Monitor's Tom Peter has been reporting on Syria. He's based on the border in Antakya, Turkey. Tom Peter just returned from a reporting trip to Aleppo, Syria, and he joins us on the phone now. Tom, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start with basically what you are seeing among the people that you talk to. What did you see in Aleppo?
Well, I've been going in and out of Aleppo since late August, and it's really stark in terms of how this optimism that people were feeling in the beginning. Because, you know, remember in Aleppo particularly, the revolution and the uprising, all the fighting didn't really start until last summer. So even though it's been going on for 2 years throughout Syria, in Aleppo it's about, you could say it's about a year old, even though there was stuff happening before that, but the fighting had been going on for about a year. And now, you know, you had people that used to think that the situation would be at least under control in terms of having the opposition control most of Aleppo and really had being closer to getting rid of Assad. They thought that was going to be potentially happening by this time. But the situation is still far from under control. There's still, you know, front lines are pretty stagnant, and Assad isn't showing any signs of going anywhere. And meanwhile, you're seeing, you know, the economy has been devastated. there's a huge spike in criminal activity. The kidnapping and ransoming industry is starting. So it's really a lot of people are kind of starting to despair. They're still enthusiastic about the revolution, but it's really a dark time for people in Syria right now.
I understand that at this point in time, most kids in Aleppo or very few kids are attending school, and that children are being conscripted into the military activities.
There's been some reports of children being involved in the conflict, but I don't really think that's a problem, in terms of children being conscripted. What you see a lot of the times when you go to these bases is sometimes there'll be orphans who are relatively young, and they kind of work as assistants to some of these military units, but it's not like child soldiers like you see in Africa where they're going out and doing fighting. There were some footage and some photographs that came out recently that I think generated a lot of conversation, but the photographs seemed relatively staged, and I think they were a little controversial. But you do see some young, teenage fighters and whatnot. But I would be hesitant to say that you're seeing a real problem or a proliferation of child soldiers throughout Syria. But there are a huge problem with kids being out of school, and most schools being closed or damaged, or there's refugees living inside schools. And also 48% of Syrian refugees now outside of the country are children. So it's children are really having a very difficult time with the conflict, as you would expect.
Well, you mentioned refugees, and what we're hearing from outside Syria is that humanitarian organizations are having a very hard time. Even if they have supplies, it's very difficult for them to get the supplies to where they're needed. So you have been doing a lot of talking with humanitarian groups. What are they saying?
Humanitarian organizations do have a difficult time operating inside Syria due to the obvious security constraints that you would expect. And one of the things that I think is really going to be a point of concern for humanitarian aid workers and journalists alike is this kidnapping and ransom problem that's starting to come up. There's a lot of some incidents now of you're hearing about aid workers facing kidnapping threats or being kidnapped. So that's certainly a concern. But in general, I think the biggest concern you would find is also that there just isn't a lot of money or assistance available. A lot of the support they have to get is through private donors. There is government funding, but that's probably not at the level that most organizations would think is necessary. And another point to make in terms of aid to Syria is that the U.S. has actually given quite a bit of aid, but it doesn't brand its aid because they're concerned that if they put American flags or something on the boxes, that it could create problems for the recipients or the people delivering it. So the U.S. is actually one of the larger donors in terms of humanitarian assistance, but they don't get a lot of credit for it, which is a choice that they've made, which it's quite controversial in the aid community.
We're talking with the Christian Science Monitor's Tom Peter, who I believe right now is on the border between Turkey and Syria, but recently returned just a couple days ago from a reporting trip to Aleppo, Syria. You mentioned the U.S. hesitant to put a flag on the aid that it's giving. Do you get a sense from the folks that you speak to in Aleppo or other places that they'd like to see more visible U.S. involvement or military involvement?
Well, this is one of the things that's just comes through loud and clear whenever you're talking to Syrians, is there is just a tremendous disappointment isn't a strong enough word for the response that the U.S. has had to this conflict. Now one of the things that you hear just all the time is when you're talking to Syrians is they'll say, if we don't succeed, if this revolution fails, it's not our fault, it's the fault of the United States first, and then the rest of the international community. But they more so than any other Western country, Syrians are pointing the finger at the U.S. because they perceive us as having the most resources and the greatest ability to help in terms of both military assistance and humanitarian aid. So there's just a tremendous amount of frustration with the U.S. And you know, now you're hearing all kinds of conspiracy theories that come up about the U.S. wanting to basically let Syria destroy itself, to weaken it so it can destabilize the region. Any conspiracy you can think of about why the U.S. is being rather inactive in Syria is out there in Syria. So, I mean, there's a tremendous level of frustration with Syrians right now.
One of the things that the U.S. officials, including the president, have talked about is the fact that as this war continues in Syria, there are a lot of different factions, if you will, in the rebel groups, and that it's hard to distinguish who's affiliated with whom. And is that your perception as well, that the anti-Assad factions are wide-ranging and do have different political affiliations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there really is no unity among the Free Syrian Army, which, you know, is a kind of the blanket term people use for anti-Assad groups. However, I mean, I would say that while you have groups that are as diverse in their political beliefs as, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the group that has, their leader has pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda, and the U.S. classifies them as a terrorist organization, to more moderate groups that, are somewhat secular in their thought. You have that range. However, unless the U.S. intelligence community is, I mean, completely and criminally incompetent, they would be able to distinguish the difference between who's who. And I would be shocked to find out that the intelligence community doesn't have a good read on who to supply weapons to. And from certain people I've talked to who've had communication with, officials in the Department of Defense or the U.S. military that are, monitoring the situation, there seems to be a very good understanding of who's who in the revolution. And should the decision be made to provide lethal assistance, meaning weapons, heavy artillery and that sort of thing, that they should have a pretty good idea of who to give it to. But certainly the concern is that, groups that are perfectly secular right now in their thought and would be ideologically what the U.S. would want to support inside Syria, they do work alongside these other groups like Jabhat al-Nusra on the front line. So there is a concern that, in cooperating through the course of battle and what have you, that these weapons could change hands. So that is a concern, but the U.S. should really have a pretty good handle on who's who, and I would be very surprised if they didn't.
Are we beyond the point of a political solution to what's happening in Syria?
That's a tough question. I would say that it seems unlikely that we're going to find a negotiated solution, if that means having Assad and his supporters, move to, say, the northwestern part of the country, in Latakia province, where he has many of his strong base of support, and maybe retire or go to some other country. I don't think we're going to see that. Assad has showed no real clear indication of any willingness to do that, and I don't know if there would be an acceptance among the general Syrian population of that kind of decision. So, I guess what we have to look at is eventually Assad is going to have to go some way, but then I think what we're moving into, I mean, this is where the divisions in among the opposition are a real problem, because after Assad does go, even if there's some, magical negotiated solution, what we then have to deal with is all of these opposition groups that have incredibly, their political beliefs run the entire spectrum, and there's no clear leader, or there's no clear group that will replace Assad and his regime. So there's a lot of people that will talk now about how, okay, we're working with a group like Jabhat al-Nusra today, but tomorrow we might be fighting them whenever Assad goes, because we don't want some kind of, Islamic government inside Syria. So it's really complicated. I mean, even if Assad goes, then you have these problems inside the opposition, and there just isn't any, there's no clear political solution to negotiate at this point. So I think the very sad and unfortunate reality is that we're looking at a long, protracted conflict, and or at least unstable situation, even after Assad is removed from power, which could explain part of the hesitancy that the U.S. and other countries are having when they are thinking about backing troops, because I don't think they want to be blamed for that.
So there's this political uncertainty. Infrastructure-wise, if the civil war ended this week, what would Syria need? What would it look like, and what would it need just to function?
Well, let me first qualify this by just saying that in my travels inside Syria, it's all been inside Aleppo and, you know, the city and the province. So I haven't had a good chance to look at other areas that have been affected by the fighting. But what I can tell you from what I've seen in Aleppo, I mean, it's just complete and total devastation in many areas. You have the electric grid, which has been destroyed by and large. I mean, it's still power that's delivered, but, you know, it gets cannibalized and people are taking parts to try to make things work. You have water mains that have been broken. I mean, you name it, it's any piece of infrastructure, it sustains some damage. I mean, roads have been broken. In places that are along the front line, there's entire blocks that are just destroyed. I mean, it's, you know, when I was in Aleppo last week, you know, we drove through one area where there'd been a Scud missile attack, and, you know, literally just one missile, it just leveled an entire block in a city. So, I mean, that's just from one small attack. So you go to these areas where there's been heavy fighting and there's been airstrikes and artillery and all of these things that, you know, the entire neighborhoods are in ruins. So you have, you know, everything from the physical structure of buildings to electricity and water mains and all of that that's just completely destroyed.
I think that's hard for many Americans who haven't been in a war zone to even imagine. It's the stuff of science fiction.
I can tell you, I mean, I've worked in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and I've never seen destruction of this magnitude. It's difficult to comprehend just how bad it is there. And you know, certainly from all of the different war zones I've visited, I've never seen anything this bad.
So we're listening to you describe this. I have to think back to the focus in this country on chemical weapons and their importance in all of this. You know, when there's no houses and no water and no electricity and you have no shelter or food, I wonder what the people feel about chemical weapons. That just seems like one more straw on this horrible pile.
Well, I mean, that's the, you know, I guess the U.S. officials are saying they have strong evidence, and, you know, but they're kind of hemming and hawing, saying, well, we can't be certain how they were delivered or whatnot. So they're continuing with the policy of inaction and not acting on this red line that President Obama said would occur if you know, the Syrian government used chemical weapons, they would become involved. So if you talk to Syrians, it's not up for debate whether the Assad regime has used chemical weapons. They know it's very clear. He's been using them consistently, you know, not on a massive level, but we're talking regular attacks using chemical weapons that have occurred. And now they're all aware of this red line. They read the news, and they you know, despite the destruction, they still do have access to, well, you know, the internet, and they can hear the radio or see TV news. So they know about this red line. And so, you know, this frustration and the anger that they feel about American and Western inaction is just magnified tenfold when you have something like these chemical weapons attacks happening that were supposed to be a red line, and they don't elicit any response from the U.S. And also, there's concern that this is a clear message to the Assad regime that they can continue this kind of one-upsmanship and continue to really push up against these so-called red lines and not face any consequences. So, you know, and even to begin with, the idea that that chemical weapons is somehow the red line is ridiculous to many Syrians. You know, there's a lot of people will joke that, well, is gunpowder not a chemical? So it's okay if you drop a 500-pound bomb on a gathering of civilians, but, you know, somehow it's not okay if you put a little sarin gas in it. It still has the same effect, which is mass destruction and the killing of civilians.
A last question for you, Tom. How is it for you, safety-wise, traveling between Turkey and Syria? Is it still really dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a consideration these days. And, there's always a threat of, when you're working in a place like Syria, there's always the threat of the violence that's happening, particularly, the artillery or airstrikes. Except just random, and it's very easy to get caught up in. But now one of the really big concerns, again, is this kidnapping and ransom industry that seems to be starting up. I had an experience in November where I was abducted for about 5 hours at gunpoint by an Islamic group inside of Aleppo. So these things are a real concern and a consideration for reporters and my colleagues who are working out here.
Well, I hope you stay safe, Tom, and thanks for your good work.
Yeah, well, thank you. My pleasure.
Tom Peter is the Syria correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who joined us from the Turkish-Syrian border town. Thank you so much. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Do successful politicians today portray themselves as more sensitive, more caring than politicians used to? If so, is it because they have to in order to get elected? Our next guest says yes. He'll explain in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts and Expo 13, May 10th through the 25th. Expo 13 builds upon the annual BFA exhibition, highlighting the depth and range of students' creative inquiry and expression. Opening party May 10th, 5 to 9 p.m. Information at cornish.edu/expo.
54 degrees in Seattle, mostly sunny. Forecast says it'll be at least partly sunny all day with an afternoon high of 69, and then mostly sunny tomorrow Friday with a high of 72. A bit later this hour, we're going to learn about a dance performance inspired by the choreographer's schizophrenic mother and intended to spark conversation about the American mental health system. How do you do that with dance? We'll find out in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. We live in a culture that values being in touch with our feelings, and we expect our civic and political leaders to be in touch with not only their feelings, but ours as well. This winter and spring, University of Washington Communications Professor David Domke is presenting a five-part series of talks about what it takes to win the White House, the final rule for aspiring presidents feel people's pain. He's going to be talking about that tonight. David Domke, welcome back.
Good morning.
So when I hear a phrase, I feel your pain, I have to flash on former President Bill Clinton. Did he actually say that?
You know, that's an interesting question. He did say that, but it's really hard to find the public moment when he did. You have to look carefully. He's more known for just emoting it through his body language, right? The biting of the lip, the little drooping of the eyes. And he is, though, the kind of turning point moment in what I call the empathic presidency, where his moment in one of the debates with George H.W. Bush, where Bush is known for looking at his watch. It was after a question. Bill Clinton followed that up. And after Bush looked at his watch, Clinton walked over to the person, got right next to them and talked to them like they were friends. And it was at that moment, I suggest, that the birth of the empathic president occurred.
Well, it got me to thinking when I knew I was going to talk with you about this, about Steven Spielberg's recent film, Lincoln, yeah, in which he's portrayed as not only a savvy politico, sort of shepherding through what he wanted, but also somebody who at least had a semblance of some kind of empathy. And I wondered if that was a 21st century filmmaker looking back at a presidency that might not have been that way.
My sense is the answer to that question would be yes, that it is largely a post-Bill Clinton, post-1992 kind of notion of what a politician should be like. If you look at at least the modern presidency, which might be defined as Franklin Roosevelt forward, when we've had modern media, a very diverse society. That's been an area of research of mine. And Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, our three most recent presidents, have all used what you might call empathic language, language of caring and understanding, three times more than the presidents that preceded them. So there's something very different about now and how presidents talk.
Is that a demand from us, or is that a demand, I wondered, of the 24-hour news cycle and the way we cover all this stuff?
I think it's both. I think it's that the American public has been trained culturally a bit by our media environment to want something that cuts through the kind of bombardment of constant information and messages. And what cuts through that but emotion, feeling, a sense that this president feels their pain, right?
So just to keep using that term over and over again. So was that Mitt Romney's downfall in 2012?
It was. Yeah, you know, if you look at the exit poll data, that pollsters will ask the question of people leaving the polls, what was the most important candidate characteristic that, you know, was part of your voting? And there's usually four or five of those. And on four of those, Mitt Romney, if voters picked the characteristic, Mitt Romney drew more of their vote. The only one that Barack Obama won was the characteristic of cares about me. Huh. And so Obama won that one, and he won it 81% to 18%.
Is that why, in particular, at the Republican convention, there was a whole lot of, I guess it was his handlers and his wife brought in to portray my husband or my candidate, the incredibly caring human being that he is, not the competent man who could run the country?
Absolutely. That's why they did that. And he missed it. He from the beginning, missed the opportunity of sharing about his faith and about being a father and all of those pieces that really do give people a well-rounded picture of who you are and make them feel like you could be in the church pew next to them or something like that. He neglected to do that all the way through. And the Obama campaign used that to their advantage. Barack Obama won this presidency, this re-election, largely on the strength of his sense of, I care more about you than Mitt Romney does.
I want to talk about Barack Obama in a second, because I think he's an interesting contradiction in empathic and cerebral. But
yeah.
But this whole idea of Mitt Romney's inability to convey that message despite the best efforts of his handlers brings up another question, which he kept emphasizing was his competency. So do we as the electorate no longer care if we hire anybody? Because essentially when we elect them, we're hiring them for a job, right?
Right.
Aren't they supposed to be able to do the job?
Competence, you know, is kind of the ability to do the job. Integrity is the sense of, do you trust the person?
Sure.
And then empathy is the sense of, do you relate? Does the person understand you? Those three characteristics have been, for a long time, key determinants of who people vote for at the presidential level. I am making the argument tonight and in this lecture that the shift has moved from competence and integrity to empathy, competence has always been there in the presidency. Integrity was there for a period of time post Watergate as a very big deal, and empathy now is a defining characteristic.
I remember the Kennedy Nixon televised debate. I was in first grade, and we voted in my class. It was my first Democratic action, and Kennedy won by about 75%. But I remember and also have read in retrospect that there was also, it wasn't whether he was an empathetic character or not, but he was an attractive character. How much does the external packaging play into our perception of a candidate's empathetic character?
It matters. There's no question. I mean, being better looking in cultural standards than less is always beneficial to anybody in the public realm. But you think about, let's use Clinton, Bush, and Obama, which
sure.
is the focus of my lecture series, looking at those three presidents because they're the first three consecutive two-term presidents since Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. So what do we learn by looking at these three? Well, what we learn is that Bill Clinton was this kind of he's known as the empathic president.
Sure.
Okay, George W. Bush ran on a platform of compassionate conservatism. Okay, making the case that he, as a conservative, understood people and wanted to meet them where they were. That he wasn't a mean conservative. That he was a compassionate one, and I'll talk about why that helped him. I'll talk about that tonight. And then Barack Obama, who is this highly intellectual, almost aloof kind of individual, still has, nonetheless has had these moments where he's broken through.
And most recently, we've seen that, unfortunately, as president, he's had to attend a bunch of right. memorials for shooting victims of Newtown, for the bomber of the Boston Marathon bomber. Right. And what he's done in those is give these speeches that sort of hit the ball out of the park when you come to Message I Care, which is, I'm quoting H.W. Bush, I believe, with Message I Care, yes.
Right. So George H.W. Bush in 1992 famously said at a town hall, Message I Care, which is what a lot of people have said he was actually reading a cue card. That was
the message.
It was Message I Care, and he just read the cue card. As supposedly, and that's supposed to mean that this is how out of touch he was, is that like he just read the cue card. Barack Obama has had these moments, the ones you just mentioned, and then back in 07 and 08 when he gave these speeches mm-hmm. that connected, that convinced a lot of people that they loved him or that he would get them at some level. And Michelle Obama helps a lot too, okay? More than any first lady in a long time, I think. Really humanizes him. So I think Barack Obama actually is quite aloof. And he seems to be not the high extrovert that a Bill Clinton is, for example. I think Bush, George W., and Bill Clinton are far more people-centered people than Obama is. But Obama has the ability to connect empathically through these speeches. And I think those moments carry him.
And Romney didn't have that ability.
No, Romney seemed to actually have a fairly decent ability one-on-one mm-hmm. with people. You heard these stories throughout the campaign of him deeply touching people emotionally in some kind of moment. Or you heard a little bit of this during the convention of him giving the eulogy at a funeral, right? Those are really human moments. But those weren't the messages that they emphasized, right? And through in a media age, you've got to be able to emote through media. And that's a skill.
Well, we have to we expect our candidates and our politicians to emote through media, and we also expect them to be like constantly updating this empathetic message that they give, because the news cycle is, you know, 15 minutes long or something like that now in the era that we're in. And it seems like that is putting much. Just to go back to Lincoln, you know, what were they covering? A speech every 3 weeks if he made it by train to their town, gave a speech,
right.
Somebody wrote something and it went back by train or by, you know, telegraph they weren't under that same kind of pressure. It seems like we're asking not only that somebody know how to budget and know about foreign policy, but they have to be like total social animals. That seems extreme.
Yeah, we have what exists now is known as the permanent campaign. And Bill Clinton was the first one to enact this, that you never, ever stop campaigning for what you do and who you are. And Obama actually did kind of stop campaigning in his first term, and that hurt him tremendously. He thought, I'm just going to let this Congress work on this instead of him getting in there and campaigning for it. He's been very different in his second term on gun control and on immigration. So the permanent campaign as a cultural phenomenon demands a candidate who can seemingly be giving you a message you've never heard before that he or she has never delivered to anyone before, but yet they've delivered it millions of times, right? And that takes skills. And Mitt Romney was a CEO, okay? Very competent, right?
Right.
Absolutely. But that wasn't enough for people in this environment.
So looking ahead in the great vast crystal ball of speculation about presidential politics, already candidates from both parties are jockeying because we got
sure.
two open slots, no incumbent. People have lately been talking about Marco Rubio, who's trying to make nice on the extremist image of his party when it comes to gun control. What does somebody need to emulate Bill Clinton, or in 3 years, in 2 years, in 1 year when the campaign actually begins, or now when the campaign starts, do they have to refine even further who that, I mean, do they have to be empathetic in 140 characters?
They do. They absolutely do. So Hillary Clinton, as she runs, is the clear front runner on the Democratic side. She needs to find that, calibrate that balance for her of being kind of a tough but also empathic. And she's going to constantly be in the shadow of Bill on that. On the Republican side, they don't have to be as good as the Democrats because the Democrats are actually seen by the public as more empathic than Republicans. They simply have to be not mean, right? And Mike Huckabee in 2008 said, "I'm a conservative, but I'm not mad about it." That's what they have to be seen as. And that's where the compassionate conservatism really helped Bush.
What about somebody like Chris Christie, who, when Superstorm Sandy hit, put aside, or theoretically put aside, politics, and it's like, you know, not back to message I care, but that is in my head, because whenever you talk about empathy, I have to relive that moment. But he did. I mean, he went and fought for his citizenry.
Yeah. So in my lecture series, every night I end with kind of an assessment of the current candidates. How do they score on this rule? Mm. And Christie is the strongest on empathy of the Republican side. That he's, it's partly because of who he is and what he looks like. And people feel like he's an everyday guy.
Sure.
But it's also because he kind of is brash and calls it like it is. And he gets out there and he embraces and hugs people. He's a tough guy, but he loves people, right? And I don't think any other Republican candidate right now scores as high on empathy as he does. And so I think he'll be formidable on that if he becomes a nominee.
I can't help but listen to this. And I'm not going to run for the president of the United States, but it just seems that what we are asking of the person who would seek this office is someone who is almost in the stratosphere of superhuman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the lecture series, I've talked about a series of different characteristics. So you got to be smart. You got to be authentic. You have to be able to connect with the base of the party. You have to be tireless. You have to be, in this case, empathic. And yeah, we are. We're asking an awful lot of one person. That's because this is really the American monarchy. It's what the king, the presidency is. So we don't have royalty per se. What we have is politicians that we create that way. And that's why they always let us down. They always let us down because we think they become too big of symbols for us. At the same time, it also is what captivates us, right? That this could be the case. And that's certainly been the case in my analysis.
We've been talking with David Domke. He's professor and chair of the communications department at the University of Washington. The final lecture in his series about what it takes to win the White House is tonight at Kane Hall on the University of Washington campus. And it is Feel People's Pain.
Yeah.
Message I Care. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW 942. Choreographer Ezra Dickinson's latest work takes on the American mental health care system. We'll find out how and why in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
56 degrees in Seattle, mostly sunny. Forecast says partly sunny through the day with an afternoon high of 69. Some clouds overnight with a low of 47, and then tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 72.
Support for KUOW comes from GET, Washington's guaranteed education tuition program, helping parents plan and save for college. With flexible options, a nationwide choice of colleges, and backed by the state of Washington. Information and enrollment online at get.wa.gov.
President Obama is heading to Mexico to talk with Mexico's relatively new president about trade and security. More in our top-of-the-hour newscast, which is about 20 minutes away.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. It's Thursday, and this is the day we check in with some of the art that's being made in our city of Seattle. Today, choreographer and performer Ezra Dickinson's with us. On Monday, this coming Monday, Ezra will debut a site-specific performance called Mother for You, I Made This. Nice to have you in the studios.
Thanks for having me here.
This performance is a collection of some things that you really did make for your mother. So before we get to the reason why you made this, can you describe what the performance will be?
The performance is, like you said, a collection of solos that I've been making for my schizophrenic mother for about 7 years that are intended as gifts for her. And I started doing this as kind of a student project in college. We were asked to make a self-portrait of ourselves, and I chose to make a portrait of my life with my mother when I was younger. And, you know, it began a story inside of me that I think had always been there, and I think it just blossomed a flower for me to explore and find a really deep purpose inside of creating choreography and dance for myself.
I had read, or somebody told me, that it was your mother who was responsible for sort of propelling you into a dance career in the first place. So was she a dancer?
Yeah, my mom was a dancer and a dance teacher, and she put me in dance when I was about 4 years old.
Wow.
And I never had any classes with her. I never studied dance with her. What she more imparted to me was making me stretch on a daily basis and making sure that I was staying up on my push-ups and my sit-ups and stretching my feet out and things like that.
When were you aware that your mother had a mental illness?
Well, my mother wasn't diagnosed with schizophrenia until after I moved out of her house. I think probably I was about 19 or 20. But as I have grown older, looking back at my childhood, my mother was, she was schizophrenic all through my whole life. But being an only child, you know, I had no basis for comparison. And so I assumed that, you know, the way that my mother was how all mothers were. And as a child, I think I built many coping mechanisms and ways to kind of bring my mother back to reality and keep her kind of stable inside of, you know, the world that we had together. But I think as I moved out and as I started to live on my own, you know, that removed that task from her life, and her mental illness, I think, started to take hold much more so.
Was she on her own after you moved out?
Yeah, she was. She moved down to Seattle, and then when I started to live on my own, she moved back to Bellingham and continued to live on her own until I think, you know, mental illness started to come out more so, and then it's kind of assisted living, a cycle of being inside of assisted living and then not taking her medications and being kind of arrested for disorderly conduct of some form or another and taken off to mental institutions and then, you know, medicated, released, and then the cycle just kind of repeats itself.
And what was your relationship with your mom? This was about 10 years or so ago, right?
Yeah.
So how involved were you in her life at that point?
Well, I would talk to her on a weekly basis. It's very difficult because she does not want to acknowledge her mental illness. And, you know, so that puts a roadblock up right from the start. When she's has been in a mental institution and is currently, she doesn't want me to come and visit her. She doesn't allow me any sort of visitation in that sense. I've only recently found out that I am her legal guardian, and I actually have a little bit of leeway to, you know, start to talk to some of her doctors and find out some of the information that up until recently I had no way of even getting a hold of and didn't know that I even had the ability to get a hold of it.
So you didn't, how did that happen? Did she make you her legal guardian?
Yeah, she made me her legal guardian.
But you didn't know about it?
I didn't know about it.
Wow.
And this is the way that my mother is. She's very smart and she's very secretive. And, you know, there's not a whole lot that I can do to sway her opinion in one way or another. So she'll kind of make choices on her own. And sometimes she'll tell me about them and sometimes she won't.
You mentioned, and I've heard this from other people who have loved ones, family members who are struggling with mental illness, that there are cycles where she's taking medications or she's institutionalized or in some kind of care situation. And then there are situations, the spiral is at the ebb, the bottom, where she is off the medications, maybe not under any kind of roof. Isn't that right?
Yeah, yeah. There's been a number of times when she has called me up and has kind of casually conveyed to me that she's been living on the street. And, you know, part of her wants to tell me about this, but another part of her doesn't want to talk about it. And it's just this very, you know, for me as an artist, it's a very surreal world to exist inside of. And as a dancer and as a visual artist, I can't help but think about, you know, images of my mother, you know, in this state. It just makes me want to make things for her and to process this information for myself.
So when you were in school and you started addressing your mother's situation and your relationship with your mother, where was she at that point? Was she in an institution? Was she on the streets? Where?
All of the above.
Wow. And when she was out homeless someplace, did you actually see her? Did you interact then?
No. I didn't get to see her. I only got phone calls. I've only, you know, she came down to see me graduate in 2007 from Cornish, and she saw me dance then. I went up to visit her up in Bellingham, I think maybe a year or two after that, and then I haven't seen her since then. She's been in transit, and my life has been busy, and the best that I've been able to do is to talk to her as often as I can.
We're talking with dancer and choreographer and visual artist Ezra Dickinson and his mother. Her mental illness and her relationship with you have been the catalyst for a series of dances that you made for your mother, but it sounds like your mother never saw these dances. She hasn't seen any of them.
No, my mother hasn't gotten to see any of these dances. I think, you know, part of me would love for her to see this work. Part of me is very content with the idea of making gifts for her, sharing this with an audience, and kind of creating good thoughts and energy that can go out into space and can help her. As a poor artist, I don't feel like I have a whole lot of avenues that I can, you know, help my mother, but this is one that to me is very meaningful. And, you know, through showing this to other people and audience, it has shown me that it can activate, you know, a very strong response and something that a lot of people are very receptive to.
Well, in fact, it's described, Velocity Dance Center is sort of your producing partner with this project that, and I think this is the first time that all these dances are going to be brought together into one piece, right?
Yeah.
And they said that they describe you as part artist, part activist, and that part of, for you, putting together this project is to not just show the dances, but to stimulate a conversation about mental illness?
Yeah, yeah. You know, all through creating these solos for my mother, I have gone through many different sides of what it's felt like to, you know, have a parent with mental illness. I think I've began in a place of feeling very alone on this subject of not knowing how to move forwards, how to cope with this, how to help. And as I've ventured into this project further, I've found that, you know, opening up myself to others, having conversations about this work has not only given me avenues to resources, but has also shown me the closeness that almost everyone that I talk to has with this subject and the amount that we all share with this subject. And that's really, you know, it's opened a whole door of conversations. It's opened a whole door of people that are supporting this work, that are inspired by this work, that are interested in engaging in this conversation that we don't seem to know how to have in our country for some reason.
We should say there's one thing that we haven't mentioned here, which is where you're going to be performing these dances. Velocity Dance Center is producing it, but this isn't something that's taking place in a traditional performance venue.
Yeah, this work is set on the streets of downtown Seattle, and it begins at the Greyhound Station. It goes from the Greyhound Station to the Federal Courthouse. It goes from the Federal Courthouse to an alley that's nearby, and then it moves from there to a public space that's at 7th and Pine.
And why did you set these dances in those places?
I chose to take this work out of the traditional proscenium stage space because I wanted to interact with the architecture and the urban space that is where a lot of our mentally ill are existing on a daily basis. The stage space, the proscenium stage space, it is a palette that is waiting to be turned into something. But when it's turned into something, for me, I feel it is, it's always, you know, kind of a version of a realistic thing that it's trying to portray. And I'm interested in, for myself as a choreographer, trying to frame dance in a way that it is more clear and direct as to what the subject matter is dealing with. I feel in a lot of ways for new audiences coming into dance, what a choreographer is thinking about or the ideas that they are trying to portray through movement can be very foreign and very hard to understand for any new audience member. And so for myself, by creating this work outside, I'm trying to just tear away all of the layers of things that for me are unnecessary and just get right at the subject that I'm dealing with.
You've been making dance for a while in Seattle, performing for a while in other people's dances. How will you go forward after this incredibly personal piece?
Well, you know, a lot of my friends have been telling me that this is a life's work. So, I mean, this doesn't have to be, this is not an end point at all. This is the beginning of an investigation for me, not only in this subject matter, but also in this idea of performance, of taking this performance outside, of giving an audience this kind of performed tour. Every investigation opens up new ideas and new thoughts about what another investigation mm-hmm. could have in the future. So, you know, for me, this is the beginning of starting to sort out ideas that I'm interested in.
When you look back at how long, because this has been several years in thinking, what was the catalyst? Obviously, you showed it to teachers. It started as a school assignment, but what was the catalyst for you that this is time, it's time for me to actually put it together and bring it out?
I think that the catalyst was, in a lot of ways, Tanya Lockyer at Velocity and Donald Byrd as well, too. He's seen a lot of this work over the last 3 or 4 years.
At Spectrum.
I performed a lot of it down at Tacoma, and we've ended up being on the same showcases a lot. And he came right to me and started asking me about this work and started encouraging me to go further into this work and to explore it more so. But for myself, you know, because this subject is so close to me, I feel that it's all about just engaging a conversation. And the more that I get to do that, the more that it fuels the ideas that, you know, can come next.
Ezra Dickinson's a Seattle-based dancer, choreographer, visual artist. His performance, Mother for You, I Made This, debuts Monday evening in downtown Seattle. You can find out more at Velocity Dance Center's website. And then it's kind of mysterious when you go from there. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing this.
Thank you.
This is KUOW Seattle. And now, the sound of the day.
Is it Chewbacca?
It sounds a little bit like Chewbacca. It's actually a grizzly bear licking his front paw and his cage mate calling out to him on the WSU campus. Darcy sent us that sound. I don't know, I didn't realize they kept grizzly bears in a cage in Pullman.
Yikes.
Yeah, yikes is right, Bernard. Well, you may not hear grizzly bears, but you're surely hearing interesting sounds wherever you are. And we'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. There's that bear that's a little bit disturbing there. You did that on purpose, Bernard. Email the sound to weekday at kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. It can be something a little bit tamer than a bear, right?
Perhaps a trained bear.
A trained bear. That's likely to be it. Coming up in the next hour of our show, reporter Deb Wong comes in to talk about what happened on the streets of downtown Seattle last night as May Day peaceful demonstrations became not so peaceful around 8 last night. We're also going to meet Gregory Martin. His book, Stories for Boys, was selected for the Seattle Reads Project Radio Retrospective. And Sarah Dickerman coming in with another eating recommendation. Always nice to end a Thursday with thinking about food. Yeah?
Sounds good. ...56 degrees in Seattle, mostly sunny. Forecast says it'll be at least partly sunny through the day with a high of 69. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 72.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, helping physicians manage industry change so they can focus on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services is at athenahealth.com.
Okay, let's get this show on the road.
Come see how radio is really made.
Ow!
Radioactive summer session applications are open for youth ages 16 to 18.
Oh, and then this is where I have that awkward silence because I forget that it's my turn to talk.
Apply online at kuow.org/radioactive.
KUOW and the Seattle Public Library present Seattle Reads Gregory Martin's Stories for Boys, Book It Repertory Theater Staged Readings, April 22nd, 28th, and May 4th. Learn more on the events page at...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.